This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Melinda Pencava. In 1967, North Carolina became one of the first states in the country to legalize abortion. This was 6 years before the landmark Roe v. Wade case legalized abortion throughout the country, and at that time, more than 30 states had outlawed the practice. Still, North Carolina's first legalized abortion law had a number of restrictions. It could be done only if a woman's health was threatened by the pregnancy, or it was known that the child would be born with a defect, or that the woman was a victim of rape or incest. And a legal abortion back then in North Carolina also required that not one or two, but three doctors agree in writing that the procedure was justified. Those restrictions fell away after the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court ruling. The thing is, in the years since Roe v. Wade, some restrictions have been put back. Like many other states, North Carolina requires minors notify their parents before they can get an abortion. There are currently about 55 abortion providers in North Carolina, but 44% of North Carolina women live in counties with no abortion clinic. And the number of places to get an abortion has been falling in North Carolina and in the country in the past decade. The U.S. Supreme Court recently heard arguments in a case that could lead to more restrictions on abortion and less access. And there's another question. Could the president's latest nominee to the high court be a key player in overturning the Roe v. Wade decision altogether? And so, with these things going on in the country, we take a look today at abortion in North Carolina. Are the regulations in our state a reflection of what the state's residents want? How easy or difficult is it for a woman in North Carolina who needs an abortion to get one? And should the service be more or less regulated? Joining us to talk about the many different and passionate opinions on these issues, we are joined by Barbara Holt. She is president of North Carolina Right to Life, based in Greensboro, and joins us by phone. Welcome to The State of Things, Barbara Holt.
Thank you for having me.
And Susan Hill is with us. She is president of the Raleigh-based National Women's Health Organization, a network of six abortion clinics in five states. Two of them, those clinics, are here in North Carolina. Welcome to The State of Things, Susan Hill.
Thank you.
And we welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Well, I want to step back to even pre-Roe v. Wade. That's to 1967, which it may come as a surprise to many that North Carolina was one of the first states where the legislature made a law that legalized abortion. First, Barbara Holt, how was it that that came to pass here?
Well, there were individuals who were interested in seeing the laws in North Carolina liberalized, and they found willing individuals within the legislature who were interested in running legislation that would liberalize those laws. And they looked for a time when the attention of the public and even the legislature was focused on other issues and tried successfully, I might add, to get the bill through the General Assembly.
Mm-hmm. We could say that Roe v. Wade was actually a galvanizing moment, and perhaps since Roe v. Wade we discuss abortion more. Would you agree with Barbara Holt's assessment there, Susan Hill?
Actually, that's not how I remember it. I was living here in Durham, grew up in Durham, and I was in college in 67. I knew women who had who were in need of abortion. Women were going to Sherrill, South Carolina, and even to Durham for illegal abortions. And there were doctors, actually OBGYNs all over the state, who were upset about seeing the effects of illegal abortion and treating women in abortion wards. And they were concerned about why that was happening and why we couldn't have safer services and treat North Carolina women in a more medically safe way. They started working and organizing to try to liberalize the laws, at least to allow them to see North Carolina citizens, and hence the 67 law that started, to my knowledge and from what I knew at the time, from the physicians in the state.
But it did come with restrictions.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, it was not saying that you could go and get an abortion
right
easily. There were a number of stipulations.
Yes, there were.
And those, accurate assessment to say that those fell away, the ones about you needed three doctors to sign off on it, and it could only be if your health was threatened or rape or incest. Did those fall away immediately after Roe v. Wade?
When Roe v. Wade was actually, when the opinion came out, that superseded the laws that were in effect in other states.
Mm-hmm. But some restrictions have been added.
Yes.
Subsequent to. So it seems like it's an evolving thing, the abortion regulations in North Carolina and in the country.
Yes, absolutely. There was a move from the beginning after Roe v. Wade across the country to try to start regulating and to try to start limiting abortion services to women, and that's been the last 30 years battle in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, Barbara Holt, as someone with North Carolina Right to Life, as someone who opposes access to abortion or abortion in general, how would you assess the way regulations have come on the books in North Carolina? You would, I presume, would want to see more regulations than there are now.
Well, first of all, let's talk about what's happening in abortion. You have two lives. You have the life of the unborn, and you have the life of the woman who's seeking the abortion. And abortion, it takes the life of that unborn child. 18 days after conception, there's a heartbeat, and all of us would agree that we associate a heartbeat with life. For the woman who's contemplating an abortion, there are risks. And I think that she needs to be informed of those risks. We've proposed laws that or legislation that would ensure that she gets the information that she needs to make an informed decision. And so one of the pieces of legislation that's before the General Assembly now would require that she receive that information, require that she be told about alternatives, and get full information so that she can make an informed decision. I think it's interesting that there was a study at UNC by three doctors, Dr. Thorpe, Hartman, and Shanigan, that talked about informed consent implications, and they see that or saw in their reporting that there are things that women need to know that perhaps they're not being told, and they're not being told soon enough. They really, according to what they wrote, women need to know well before they're in the throes of a crisis pregnancy what the risk of preterm delivery are to future pregnancies following abortion, to depression, possible suicide, all of those things.
And so does that make the case, though, that women in general should be notified of that before they're in, as you described, a crisis pregnancy then?
I think so. I think women need to know those risks, both psychologically and physically, to abortion.
Susan Hill, you oppose that the way that's been written, at least in other states. Other states have passed such requirements.
Right, they have. And we actually have clinics in other states that have the most restrictive statutes in the country, such as Mississippi. The fact is that women are extremely intelligent. Women, I've been providing abortion services for 33 years. Women are so much better educated now. The internet has opened up another whole world to young women especially. They know more about birth control. They know more about it, sex education, and they know more about abortion. They don't ask the same questions they asked before. I find it almost offensive to really imply that women need someone else to tell them information that they don't know it themselves, and when in fact they ask us things that we have to go check on. So I think that this is it's an interesting political angle on it. But if you talk to young women, anyone who does now, they know that they know more than my generation knew, the generation after me. And informed consent has always been required in North Carolina for any type of surgery. The informed consents that we give in other states are what the state has mandated, but those same pieces of information were given before. A general blanket informed consent to all women of North Carolina before they're in the throes of a pregnancy. I'm not sure exactly how that's accomplished.
Would the idea of the informed consent, of getting that the state mandating that certain information be given to women, almost down to the wording of it, that is how it's done in other states.
Yes.
A doctor shall say these words.
There's a script.
Does that go hand in glove with the idea of waiting a day? Because there are also the delays. Have to wait 24 hours before.
Right, that is certainly part of a 24-hour waiting period. It's done in other places without a 24-hour waiting period, but it certainly the model that the Right to Life movement has really introduced into most states is the 24-hour waiting and with the consent.
Right. As with any debate on abortion, as I think anybody who's been paying attention to this issue over the past 32 years would know, I mean, we could stay here an hour and talk about the merits of this particular thing, but I do want to talk about politically, why is it that North Carolina has the laws it has compared to other states and compared to other states in the South? And Barbara Holt, it is a fact that since about 8 years ago, there's not been a change in North Carolina's abortion laws. There have been certainly proposals virtually every year to put changes in the state's laws to add restrictions, such as the one you're describing. Why do you think that the restrictions haven't happened, whereas it's other states have had an easy anti-abortion groups in other states have had an easier time of putting restrictions on their state's laws?
Well, I would call these laws or legislation that's been proposed as protections. I mean, they protect the person that is getting the abortion and provide, in the case of parental consent, which was passed in 95, ensure that parents are involved in this life-altering decision that their minor child is considering.
We may have to put you on hold for a second because we have to come back and we'll get to the question of why these have not passed in North Carolina. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. This is the State of Things. We're talking today about North Carolina's abortion laws and access to abortion in North Carolina. With us are Barbara Holt, president of North Carolina Right to Life, based in Greensboro, and Susan Hill, who is president of the Raleigh-based National Women's Health Organization, which has abortion clinics in six states, including in Raleigh. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Melinda Pencava. In North Carolina, over 180,000 women of reproductive age became pregnant in the year 2000. Now, 66% of these pregnancies resulted in live births, 19% in induced abortions. This hour, we're talking about North Carolina's laws regarding abortion and the ongoing issue of access to abortion in North Carolina and in the country. We are joined by Barbara Holt. She is president of North Carolina Right to Life, that is based in Greensboro, and Susan Hill, who is president of the Raleigh-based National Women's Health Organization, which has abortion clinics in six states, including in Raleigh. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Before the break, we were talking about North Carolina being one of the first states to put a law on the books in 1967 that legalized abortion. There were a number of restrictions on it. Then Roe v. Wade came along, the Supreme Court decision. A lot of those restrictions were lifted. Some have been put back, but clearly not as many as other states. And Barbara Holt, do you have any explanation as to why? There certainly have been abortion opponents such as your group and others have recommended, asked the legislature to put more restrictions on abortion access in the state. But since 1997, there's not been a new restriction put on abortion here.
Well, the parental consent law went into effect in 1995, and that basically protects minors because they need parents involved in life-changing decisions such as abortion. Abortion cannot be undone, so that involves the parents. It's a one-parent consent law. Unfortunately, because there's no notarization of that consent, teens have been circumventing their parents' consent by forgery. And one of the bills that we have before the legislature is to add notarized consent. I don't know why the leadership in the House and the Senate don't allow these bills to come forward. The majority of Americans support parental consent. They support parental involvement in a minor's abortion. They support informed consent laws. 75% and greater of those surveyed say that they feel that a woman should be given full information before she has an abortion and support that period of reflection. 24 hours is a very short time to reflect on the information that would be given to her.
Well, Susan Hill, I have heard other abortion providers, such as yourself, say that that delay, that 24-hour period, in theory may be okay, but it affects women who perhaps are poor and have to travel a long distance to a place to get an abortion.
Right. In our Mississippi clinic, which, like I said before, is the most restrictive, there is a 24-hour waiting period. That is the poorest of the poor state. Women from the Delta are incredibly poor, even to my amazement, when I see them. We have found women who, to comply with the 24-hour waiting period, have slept in their cars overnight in the parking lot of the clinic, unbeknownst to us, with two or three of their family members because they had to stay and they had to comply with these things. You know, for most women who are of average income or above, there's a lot of things that are easier. But for a poor woman who has to worry about child care for her children at home, has to visit a clinic that's 4 hours away or 7 hours away, come back the next day or next subsequent days, it becomes incredibly burdensome for her. And, you know, there are very few exceptions to that 24-hour waiting period. I will say one thing. In Mississippi, it hasn't changed the number of women that we see. The mandated informed consent that we have to read to them has not changed the women coming back the next day. If anything, they seem sure of their decision. And in some ways, I think it hasn't worked in the way that the other side thought that it would.
Your abortion clinic in Mississippi, in Jackson, Mississippi, was recently the focus of a Frontline special on public television. And it gets to the question that I'd like to talk about today, and that was how North Carolina compares to some other states, especially states in the South. And the argument was made in that program that though there has been hue and cry, a grand debate over abortion in the 32 years since Roe versus Wade, and abortion opponents have called for the overturning of Roe v. Wade, that may not happen, but by adding regulations at the state level, it chips away at the access women have to abortion. So practically speaking, you had a state like Mississippi where your clinic is the only one in the state. How has that been done there? I mean,
there were a lot of political reasons that Mississippi is down to one clinic now. And doesn't mean that the women seeking abortion isn't the same. It means that they don't have the same places to go to, and they're forced to travel farther distances for that. What I continue to say is, no matter what people have opposed, no matter the political argument over 33 years that I've been doing this, the statistics remain relatively constant. There has been a high of 1.5 or 6 million women every year who seek abortion and obtain them. The low has been 1.2 million. Over 33 years, that's an incredibly small swing, and it's been cyclical, up and down. So there's so much of this is a political argument as opposed to dealing with the needs of women that are seeking abortions, have always sought abortions, and will continue to in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, Barbara Holt, your take. Why does that work in Mississippi and not in North Carolina? Why have the abortion opponents been successful in Mississippi and not here?
Well, I'd like to go back to the 24 hours because the legislation that's been proposed in North Carolina says that the physician who is to perform the abortion, the referring physician, or a qualified person has informed by telephone or in person the woman of this information 24 hours before the abortion. So it is possible, you know, these circumstances that Susan is portraying, I don't think would, if this legislation became law in North Carolina, would pose those same kinds of situations. And another thing that people need to realize is that abortions can be done in hospitals in North Carolina. They don't have to be done in a freestanding facility such as the Raleigh Women's Health Clinic. They can be done in a hospital because that's what state law says. So with regard to why we don't have laws like they do in Mississippi, once again, it's not because they haven't been proposed. Legislation hasn't been proposed. It's because these bills don't get brought up in the General Assembly.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's a figure. 55 places in North Carolina provide abortions as of a few years ago, and that's down a few since the mid-90s. Susan Hill, would you have expected 3 decades after Roe v. Wade that there would be more places where women, North Carolina women, could get abortions, or would you expect fewer than 55, or is this, if you were to peer into a crystal ball 3 decades ago, would you say 55 places is what you would expect?
Well, two things. 55 doesn't indicate that abortions are being done a lot in those places. The North Carolina law, I believe, is if anyone does over 10, they have to report as an abortion provider in a year. So a hospital or a doctor may do 2 and still report in. So the majority of abortions being done in North Carolina are like every place else. They're being done in freestanding facilities. North Carolina regulates its clinics. It always has. From 73, it regulated its clinics. They're inspected each year. They're under the auspices of the state of North Carolina and have to comply with the rules that everyone else does, hospitals, surgery centers, whatever. So it's been a rational approach, I think, to providing those services. When I started in 1973, I thought that in 2005, women would go to their private gynecologist and talk to them privately about their need and that the doctor would provide the service in private like he or she provides every other service for women. Mm-hmm. I never thought there would be clinics in 2005. I thought it would be a thing of the past.
Specific places that specialized.
Exactly.
Yeah. Barbara Holt, what was your take? Would you have expected more or fewer places to get an abortion in North Carolina?
Well, when abortion was legalized in 73, I expected exactly what we have today, that all of life would be devalued, so that we are talking about more than abortion today, because our organization deals with life from conception to natural death, and so we're dealing more and more with euthanasia, assisted suicide, as well as abortion. So we see that life all along the spectrum has been devalued.
There are 78 counties in North Carolina that do not have abortion providers.
Yes.
In them. And the statistics say 44% of North Carolina women live in those counties. Are they ending up driving to places like Raleigh?
Yes,
in
they
your
travel.
Clinic?
They travel like every other state now. Women travel from as far away as Manio to Murphy, as the slogan goes, to Raleigh, to Chapel Hill, to Charlotte, for their services and deal with all of the problems that occur. It's almost as if, again, in 67, when women were traveling out of North Carolina into South Carolina to back alleys and secretly leaving and not being able to tell their families where they're going for the day.
Mm-hmm. We are talking today about access to abortion in North Carolina. Their abortion is once again in the news, as if it has ever really left. It's always been on at least a low boil, sometimes flaring up over the past 3 decades since the Roe v. Wade decision. Supreme Court is the flashpoint for this right now. There's a case before the Supreme Court that's been argued about the limit of states to put restrictions on abortion. There's also a nominee to the Supreme Court, and that could change the balance and perhaps Roe v. Wade. We welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. And we go to Chapel Hill. Hi there.
Hi. My name's Emily, and I'm really happy we're having this conversation. I feel like we haven't talked about this in a while. But what I want to talk about is I'm really alarmed by this proposed 24-hour waiting period legislation. When I think about it, I think about what an insult it is to women, as if they haven't really considered this decision. I think it places an undue burden on poor women, on women who are living in those counties that don't have providers. And I really want to, you know, I really want us to think about what we're saying about women when we think that they need 24 hours to think about this some more. So I'm really glad to hear Susan Hill on the radio and that we're having this conversation. So thank you.
Okay. Did you have a comment you wanted to add to that?
Well, I think that we need to think about some more legislation that actually helps women have access to this really important service. And I want us to also think about how we are, what we're doing to our teens when we place the additional burden of having them have to have assigned, the consent has to be notarized. Because here we have people making a really private decision, and then we're asking someone else to enter that decision. In a lot of small communities, the notary is the person at the bank or someone else. And so here we have a family private decision that's being brought out in front of everyone. So I guess my comment or my question would be, you know, what do we think about teens and the notarization policy? And I'd like to address that to Susan Hill.
Okay, Susan. Thank you for your call, Emily.
In the 33 years that I've been doing this, most minors do talk to their parents. They talk to either one or both of their parents. Most of the minors that we see in Raleigh have at least one member of the family with them, a parent. That's always been the case, before parental notification, after parental notification. You know, this is, again, the government. What I find amazing is the right wing wanting the government to be involved in family matters and private matters, although they rail against the government being involved in anything else. If a minor has a good relationship with a parent, they are able to go to them. If they have a bad relationship, they know the reasons why. They now have an exception with judicial bypass, but it means a 16-year-old or 17-year-old has to be mature enough to find their way to a court, present themselves to a judge, which most 40-year-olds can't do within 2 or 3 days of finding out that they need to go to court. So I think, you know, doctors in this state and in other states, but certainly in this state, have been involved in this issue from the beginning. And I find it really appalling that people believe reputable, good doctors who do work in clinics, contrary to what people believe, and the staff that is inspected by states can't help to decide whether a minor is not mature enough to have a surgery.
Barbara Holt, quickly before we go to another guest, Susan Hill makes the case that most of the teens, minors, who have come to her clinic have been accompanied by a parent. One would presume then that the parent knows what's going on. So if that's the case, why would we need a law that said that you had to notify a parent, if practically that's happening in most of the cases?
Well, I don't know that it's happening in most of the cases. We did have a court case in North Carolina. In fact, we got the call from the parent. The parent asked us if there was parental consent for abortion, and I told her yes. She said, well, my daughter had an abortion without my consent. And so we referred her to an attorney. That particular case went all the way up to the Court of Appeals. And the facts of the case were that the abortionist who performed the abortion asked the young lady if her parent signed the form. The parent was not with the child, and the child lied and said, yes, her parent signed it, and her parent did not. So we have this actual case has gone up to the Court of Appeals, and they so we know that there's a problem in North Carolina with minors getting a forged signature on a consent form, taking it to the abortionist to have the abortion done, and the parents are unaware. Mm-hmm. And so the courts basically said if the consent needed to be notarized, that it needed to be in the law. And that's one reason why we've supported legislation that would require notarized consent. Now, I know that the Raleigh Women's Health Organization requires that minors bring their parents. We would not be adverse to that requirement if the state would say that that all minor children should bring with them their parent, one parent, in order for this abortion to be done, and that the parent would have proof of the fact that they are the parent.
Susan Hill, is that the case, that you do require parents?
Yes, there are exceptions, though, and I really want to make that clear. There are times where a minor doesn't have a parent, doesn't live with a parent, lives with a grandmother, has a custodial grandparent. That's very normal in North Carolina, especially in rural areas. So that the laws that have been passed in other states, and from what I've seen in North Carolina, wouldn't allow for that, wouldn't allow. There are older sisters and older brothers that have some type of custody, maybe not legal, for their minor brothers and sisters, and would be in the role of a parent. So, you know, for every law, there's an exception. And for every law that you write, something presents itself the next week that you have to make an exception for.
Jean joins us from Burlington, or at least on the roads near Burlington. Hi there, Jean.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Just a comment as I was listening today. When I was a senior in high school, had a long-term, several-year relationship with a girl that I was engaged to. At the time, we were both 18, and a pregnancy occurred. At the time, being 18, we decided this was the best thing to pursue an abortion. We did that, and ultimately, I think the stress of that decision led to the breakup of our relationship, but it has been now some 23 years later, just a heartbreaking nightmare for both of us our entire life that that decision was made. Just a comment from a person who's walked through it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not to take sides in the matter, but when we think about the number of 1.2 to 1.5 million a year being a consistent number, and as one of your guests stated that with some sort of a pride, it sounded to me, that's 40 million-ish children that don't exist. 51% of those, more or less, are women. So to me, it's a very odd debate, and I don't understand it. And personally, I know how destructive it has been for me and for this person who I'm still friends with, thankfully. But it's a terrible pain to know that you chose to end someone's life.
Well, we have to go to a break right now, but Gene, thank you for your call. And we should say, Susan Hill, if there's 1.2, 1.5, if that number has stayed steady,
right,
the percentage of abortions have probably gone down because the population has certainly gone up in those years.
Well, except the demographics are really women between 18 and 40 or 16 and 40, and that has actually decreased in the, with the baby boom aging out.
Okay. We are talking with Susan Hill, president of the Raleigh-based National Women's Health Organization, and Barbara Holt, president of North Carolina Right to Life. And ahead, just more of your calls, 1-877-962-9862. We'll also be hearing more about abortion on the state of things. That's 1-877-962-9862. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. In the year 2000, 37,610 women obtained abortions in North Carolina. Some of these women were from other states. Some North Carolina residents had abortions elsewhere, so the number may not exactly reflect the overall abortion rate of North Carolinians. But abortions in North Carolina do represent 2.9% of all abortions performed in the United States. With us this hour to talk about access to abortion are Susan Hill. She is president of the Raleigh-based National Women's Health Organization, which operates six abortion clinics in the U.S., and Barbara Holt, president of North Carolina Right to Life. We welcome your calls as well. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Some of the current debate about abortion centers on, as we've been discussing this hour, minors' access to abortion, teenaged girls being able to get abortions. North Carolina's current law requires a minor female notify her parents of an intention to get an abortion, except in cases where the minor is a victim of rape, incest, or in a medical emergency. And in those cases, a minor may also obtain something called a judicial bypass, aside from those cases. Rivka Gordon is a physician's assistant who specializes in women's health and adolescent medicine. She is director of the U.S. Program for IPAS. That's a global nonprofit. It focuses on women's reproductive health and abortion rights. Welcome, Rivka Gordon.
Thank you very much, Melinda. I'm glad to be here.
Well, access to abortion for minors requires those women to go through extra steps, more steps than women who are, say, in their 20s or older to do. What effect does that have on the number of abortions that are performed and the health of those minor females who seek abortions?
Well, one thing I think it's important, as Susan pointed out, to remember is that the vast majority of minors do come with their parents, and their parents are supporting them through their decision. Just about 10% of adolescent women do not come with their parents, do not already have parents with them as they go through this procedure. And in my experience, those are the very most vulnerable women. When we take away the ability for a healthcare provider to provide a safety net for those women, we put them at greater risk, and that to me is a completely unacceptable situation. Mm-hmm. I remember as a adolescent medicine provider in a school-based health center, before the parental notification laws came into effect, A young woman came to me, and she had an unexpected pregnancy, and she knew she was a high school student looking forward to further education and a future, and she was not going to maintain that pregnancy. And when we talked about her parents being involved in her decision, which is what I always encouraged, she told me about her mother, who was terminally ill, who was under enormous stress, and her father was not in the picture. And she felt there was absolutely no way that she could, under these circumstances, bring her mother into this into this decision. And I was able to provide her with the safety net she needed to be sure that she got the care she needed, to be sure that she received follow-up, to be sure that she got the guidance that she needed to get the contraception she needed after her procedure so that this would not recur. I feel that this is critically important for that small number of minors, for that small number of adolescent women who just feel they cannot, for their own personal reasons, involve a parent.
And one other question for you, Rivka Gordon. Why don't more OBGYNs, gynecologists, provide abortion services? Why is it that three decades after Roe v. Wade, there are clinics such as the ones that Susan Hill operates, which, of course, would have an OBGYN performing this procedure? But why isn't it more readily available? Why is it not just done at a standard OBGYN office?
Well, I think that we live in a society, unfortunately, where those clinicians who decide that they will provide abortion care for women are taking a very, very courageous stand against significant risks. And OBGYNs, family physicians, those who take care of women have to make a very, very difficult decision about whether or not they are willing to take risks, professional risks, risks of being ostracized, risks to their safety, their family safety. It's a very, very difficult decision to make, and I don't fault anyone for not making that decision, for taking those risks. I just am in deep admiration of those few clinicians who are willing to provide this care for women.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rivka Gordon, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Rivka Gordon is a physician's assistant who specializes in women's health and adolescent medicine. She directs the U.S. program for IPAS, a global nonprofit. It focuses on women's reproductive health and rights. About the risk to the doctors, I want to go back to you for a moment, Susan Hill. You operate six abortion clinics, one's in Raleigh. And years ago, a doctor at one of your clinics in another state was murdered.
Yes. Dr. David Gunn was the first physician in this country to be murdered because he provided abortion services. He was in Pensacola, which was not one of our clinics, the day he was murdered, but he had been in our Georgia clinic 2 days before. And he had worked with us for 8.5 years. He was shot in front of a clinic entering. And there were subsequent killings after that, seven, I believe, all told, some staff members and certainly doctors. Obviously, that chilled the interest of physicians to provide abortion services. People who had provided them before and were very willing were afraid for their own safety. People that I worked with, including myself, were wearing bulletproof vests because of threats that we had had for over a year. We had federal marshals protecting three of our clinics for a year because of the very serious death threats that were being lodged against physicians and staff there.
Was that here in North Carolina? Was the North Carolina clinic one of those?
No, our federal marshals were in North Dakota, Mississippi, Wisconsin, and actually Indiana. So we had four that were being protected because of threats that the federal government had received and believed were real.
When the Supreme Court recently heard arguments in a New Hampshire case about parental notification and the larger question of whether states could impose more restrictions on abortion and when that could happen, and it was a very arcane legal argument.
Yes.
Very nitty-gritty. Less reported was another case that the High Court heard, and that was having to do with this very question.
Exactly.
You had brought suit against an abortion opponent.
Right. This last case was heard on the same morning of the argument of the New Hampshire case. It was Now v. Shidler 3, it's known as. The Now v. Shidler case was a case that Now and the National Organization for Women. Right, and had brought on behalf of women seeking abortions, and two of our clinics from Delaware and Summit had brought on behalf of clinics providing abortions. abortions in 1986.
You used the racketeering.
We used RICO. Yes,
RICO.
Right. And what commonly known as RICO, but the racketeering laws that were in existence in the 80s. And we had a federal trial, 7 weeks. The jury found the defendants guilty of 121 counts. Has been to the Supreme Court 3 times, and it was reversed at the Supreme Court, who did not allow RICO to be used on the second visit, although they had on the first, against the defendants. And now it's at the Supreme Court for the 3rd time on a technical clarification.
So your side was making the case that those who were opposed to abortion and protesting at the clinics, or
we were making a case that there was an organized plan and effort by the defendants to really organize to close down abortion clinics and to not allow women to have access to abortion clinics by illegal means.
Okay. We go to Jamie in Greensboro now. Hi there, Jamie.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. First, I want to say that I am staunchly pro-choice, and I am conflicted about the parental notification, and here's why. Back in the 80s, when I was 15, I got pregnant and I had an abortion and my parents never knew. And, you know, I'm grateful that, I was able to and that I did. However, as a 15-year-old, as a child, I had no idea what my medical history was. And at that time, they completely knocked you out with sodium pentothal. And I just think about the fact that, you know, now that I have children, you know, I could have had a heart condition or something that I didn't really know about, and I could have died on the table and my parents never knew where I was that day. And, you know, it might be easy for me to say because I was not afraid of my parents. I wouldn't have been in danger of you know, any kind of harm from them. I just had a private life I didn't want them to know about, but that's where my conflict arises from, my own personal experience, and I'd like to hear from Susan.
And Barbara Holt will bring back in. Susan, first of all?
Well, I was going to say that's not an abnormal reaction. We see parents in our clinic all the time who tell us that when they were 17, they wouldn't have wanted to get parental consent, but now that it's their children, they do. I mean, this is that constant tension between being a child and being a parent, of course. You obviously have different perspectives once you have children. The law is the law should protect the exceptions. It should be able to give some room to make individual judgments based on things that people can't anticipate when they write a law. You know, they, like I said before, we have minors that we see whose parents are in prison in other states. We have parents who are certainly in this state in the military and in Iraq, not able to communicate. There are everyday occurrences that can be exceptions to a blanket statement that every parent should be involved. Obviously abuse, obviously the things that usually are allowed for. And that's my discomfort with a blanket statement or blanket law that all minors must receive some consent from one or two parents.
Mm-hmm. Barbara Holt, I wonder if you take some comfort in what Jamie had to say there, describing herself as very much in favor of abortion rights, but on that parental notification, having qualms.
Well, in North Carolina, there's judicial bypass, and I also noticed on the Raleigh Women's Health Organization website that they talk about that. So they make teens aware of the bypass provision within the law.
Being able to go to a judge and not bypass
correct.
Your parents.
That's correct. And I would assume that most of the providers would help these minors go through that bypass procedure. But what I have seen is parents who later found out following their daughter's abortion that the daughters are suffering in some way. Perhaps they have some physical problem that's arisen since the abortion, and so the daughters needed medical care. Sometimes they notice that they're psychologically, their daughter is not right, and they don't know what's happened. And so consequently, they can't get the care that they need for their daughters because they're unaware that an abortion is taking place. Representative Linda Jones, who's offered the woman's right to know legislation in the North Carolina House, has done so because there's just such a case in her district where parents have a daughter that had an abortion. Unbeknownst to them, they saw what their daughter suffered with that abortion. She's not been right since that abortion. She's had to go through counseling. She's in, you know, her grades just took a nosedive, and the parents were unaware of what was going on. And so had they been involved to know that even if they didn't consent to the form, you know, and she went through, that she had asked them, you know, for that consent and maybe had to go to a judge and get the abortion in spite of her parents' lack of consent, at least the parents would be aware so that following that abortion, that they, if they see changes in her behavior, in her physical well-being, that they can get the proper care for her.
Mm-hmm.
But when parents are out of it, how do they know to care for their children?
Okay, we go to Rick now in Durham. Hi, Rick.
Hello.
Hi. Did you have a quick question?
Yes, very quick. It was actually a comment, and I was hoping Susan could respond to it.
Okay.
It's more just to try to keep the dialogue going, but also fair. It seemed to me, Susan, you made some very contradictory points. When it came to informed consent, you suggested that your clients were very strong, intelligent women. You said smarter than you are, smarter than most of us. And you suggested that it wasn't necessary for any additional consent. But then, on the other hand, when it comes to parental notification and use of the judicial bypass and other things, you suggest that these women are really incompetent. You said cannot find a judge. And it seems to me like that is just very contradictory.
Well, I'd love to respond.
I know brilliant people who live in Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill who are PhDs and would have a hard time figuring out a legal system. I think that the legal system is a closed system. If you had to call a judge right now, Rick, I'm not sure you would know how to ask for a judge, what you needed to do and what the procedures were without an attorney advising you. Maybe you would, and maybe you are more brilliant than anyone that I know. But the legal system is an intimidating system with the best of attorneys. And what I was saying was that I know 40-year-olds who can't navigate that system by themselves, much less 17-year-olds.
I wonder, before we close, if abortion should be treated as just another medical procedure and whether that would be problematic for both sides in this debate. On the one hand, that would mean that teens need parental notification for other medical procedures, appendectomy. A parent certainly knows about that. And that would be something problematic for your side in the debate, Susan Hill. But I also wonder, Barbara Holt, if, on the other hand, if it were treated as just another medical procedure, whether federal health programs, federal money would pay for abortions and insurance programs would not have restrictions on them. And I suppose that's a question for another day because we've run out of time for today. But I'd like to thank you both for joining us today to talk about access to abortion in North Carolina. Thank you so much. Barbara Holt is with North Carolina Right to Life and joined us from Greensboro. Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you.
And Susan Hill is president of the Raleigh-based National Women's Health Organization. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you.
And for today, that's the state of things. If you have a comment about our program, you can drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Our program is produced by Corey Princell and Megan Davis. Robin Copley is our technical director. Dave DeWitt is the managing editor. And Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thanks for listening. I'm Melinda Pencava.